Community this radio is your station. Community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Where you are now listening to The Space Show. So welcome. As I said, welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we celebrate the 55th anniversary of the second human landing on the Moon. Can you name the three astronauts on the Apollo 12 mission? Question mark. I'll leave that hanging for a moment. And how did Australia help Apollo 12? Historian Colin McKellar reveals how. So, why don't we just take off now?
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Apollo 12 was the second human landing mission to the Moon. 55 years ago, Pete Conrad, Alan Bean and Dick Gordon left the Kennedy Space Center and flew to the Moon. They went into orbit, where Conrad and Bean floated into the lunar module, leaving Gordon in the command module. While Gordon continued to orbit the Moon every 2 hours, Conrad and Bean flew the lunar module down to a landing just 100 metres from the two-year-old Surveyor 3 lander. After 2 days on the Moon, Conrad and Bean, by now the third and fourth persons to have walked on the Moon, took off and rejoined Gordon for the return trip to Earth. The mission of Apollo 12 came close to disaster just seconds after liftoff when the 111-metre-tall Saturn V rocket was hit by lightning. More about that later, but first, a song about Pete Conrad. It's called Timber Cove.
We were full of second chances. We were full of hope and promises. We were full of hugs and kisses. But I think we still had wishes. We had a cut price home. We were given free cars. But the moon isn't really that far. We went for a ride. Never thought that we'd be over the night that we drove to Timber Cove. The night we drove to Timber Cove. We'll about the black car coming up the drive. But I made you realize, I told you we'd survive, didn't I? And if I drove too fast, I didn't mean to give you a heart attack. I was always coming back. I was always coming back. That night we were starting over. The night that we drove to Timbuktu. The night we drove to Timbuktu. The night we drove to Timbuktu. The night we drove. How we drove. Standing on the edge of clearing, waiting for your heart to break. I thought I'd always stay. I thought we'd find a way.
This is the Space Show with Andrew Rennie, and I've been rather naughty. I didn't properly introduce that song. It was called Timber Cove. It was written by Darren and sung by Darren Heyman from the United Kingdom in 2019. And as I said, it's about Pete Conrad of the Apollo 12 mission. But what's the reference to Timber Cove? Well, Timber Cove is where many of the Apollo astronauts lived. And whenever an accident occurred, a black car was sent to the home of the astronaut involved. The wives came to dread this black car, waiting to see which house it would stop outside. Well, during the launch of Apollo 12, they came very close to needing three black cars, one for each of the three astronauts aboard, because the mission was struck by lightning. In an essay published in 2019, Johannes Kempinen described what happened during the lightning strike on the Apollo 12 as it ascended through clouds. This is an extract from that essay. Now, you'll hear reference to EECOM, E-E-C-O-M. And EECOM is an acronym for the Electrical, Environmental and Communication System. And to John, you also hear reference to John Aron, the flight controller monitoring that system. So here's the reading from that essay.
November 14th, 1969 was a rainy day in Florida, and this also included the Kennedy Space Center area where Apollo 12 was waiting to be launched. A cold front was passing through Florida, and this had brought unstable weather in the form of thunderstorms and rain showers. The conditions had remained such during the 13th and through the night before the launch, but weather had markedly improved since. At the time of the launch, there was no rain in Kennedy Space Center, although the sky was overcast with clouds between 600 and 3,000 meters. Weather was considered to be favorable for launch, with all the conditions that could have potentially limited it within the launch rules. Unknown to the onlookers below, as the booster passed through the overhanging cloud layer, a lightning struck the Saturn V stack just 36.5 seconds after liftoff. The tape recorder running to store data and onboard conversations captured the exchange between Commander Pete Conrad and Command Module Pilot Dick Gordon that well summed up their initial reaction. Gordon, what the hell was that? Conrad, huh? Gordon, I lost a whole bunch of stuff, I don't know. Conrad, turn off the buses. As the shrill master alarm went off in the astronaut's headphones, the caution and warning panel on the top of the main display console lit up. The yellow caution lights for all the three fuel cells and both main direct current electric power buses and both alternating current power buses were on, which meant that to the crew it appeared that all of their electric power generation and distribution systems had failed completely. The trio immediately proceeded to check the displays for indications to what exactly had happened to warrant so many alarms. No physical sensations indicated trouble to them as the Saturn V continued to ascend under the 33 meganewton thrust of its 5F1 engines. At T plus 52 seconds, a second lightning strike hit the Saturn rocket. Conrad, I just lost the platform. At this point, the NASA public affairs officer announced, altitude, 1.5 miles now. Velocity, 1,592 feet per second. Meanwhile, onboard, Gordon, all we've got's the GDC. Conrad, yes. Conrad, okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here, we had everything in the world drop out. Car, roger. The crew had barely reacted to the initial alarms when another lightning strike turned the situation a whole lot more grave. Although Pete Conrad later apparently recalled observing a flash through the small window available to him during the launch, the crew was still unaware of the true events outside. A red ISS warning light came on at the top of the console. This signified that the inertial guidance system was now in an error state and unable to sense their acceleration and attitude changes. Looking at the round instrument in front of him, Pete Conrad saw that it too was spinning around aimlessly. The inertial guidance system was no longer feeding meaningful information to the instrument that was meant to let him monitor their attitude during the ascent. Suddenly, the Apollo spacecraft had lost its bearing in regards to its position in space during one of the most dynamic and hazardous phases of the mission. Capcom Gerald Carr had no choice but to acknowledge Pete Conrad's grim declaration about losing the inertial platform. Around him, the flight controllers in Mission Control in Houston were already trying to sort out the situation, all the while the crew itself began to try to get into grips with whatever had befallen them. Yet another set of difficulties was hampering this effort. Some of the telemetry being radioed down from the ascending spacecraft had become garbled for reasons unknown and did not present an accurate picture of its condition. Looking at the main display console with the G-forces pressing increasingly on them, Pete Conrad saw that the Flight Director Attitude Indicator, or FDAI, in front of him continued to spin around, indicating that it had lost its attitude reference. Notably, however, Dick Gordon on the center seat noted over the radio that the second FDAI, which was directly in front of him, still displayed accurate information. For the launch, the commander's FDAI derived its information from the inertial guidance system. The CMP's FDAI was run as a backup by having its information fed from the auxiliary system known as the GDC, the gyroscope display coupler. Gordon, I can't, there's nothing I can tell is wrong, Pete. Conrad, I got three fuel cell lights, an AC bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, AC bus overload 1 and 2, main bus A and B out. Long pause. Bean, I got AC. Conrad, we got AC. Bean, yes. Conrad, maybe it's just the indicator. What do you got on the main bus? Bean, main bus is, the volt indicated is 24 volts. Conrad, huh. Bean, 24 volts, which is low. The crew continued to troubleshoot their spacecraft meticulously. Pete Conrad read out the warning lights he observed over the radio. While Conrad conferred with Mission Control, his compatriots sounded equally puzzled. It was Alan Bean, sitting in front of the controls and displays for the electric power system, who delivered some still confusing but yet hopeful news. By using the rotating selector switches in front of him, he was able to call up the voltage and amperage information on the power distribution buses. Despite the warnings that had lit up earlier, he found out that both the DC and the AC buses were still operating. The biggest issue noted at this time was that the DC voltage was down to 24 volts, near the minimum needed by the system that usually ran on 28 volts. Almost a minute into the emergency, the crew was still at a loss to what had happened to them, although onboard readouts told them that they still had power and a functional backup guidance system. At the ECOM station, John Aaron was manning the console where the status of the electrical and life support systems were monitored. His two cathode ray tube screens showed the real-time status of the most important telemetry values. At 37 seconds into the flight, some of the ECOM data had become garbled, consisting of unusual numbers that did not appear to indicate proper values to be measured. What was especially critical was that the telemetry measurements affected were those that covered most of the onboard power generation and distribution systems. This left mission control unable to monitor the status of the fuel cells, the batteries, or the power distribution buses. The crew reported over the air-to-ground voice radio that their power systems appeared to have a malfunction, as per the caution and warning lights Pete Conrad read out. As he looked at the screens, John Aaron recognized a pattern in the seemingly entirely random numbers on his screen. He recalled seeing something similar in the past during a test of the command module when a drop in the power to a system called the signal conditioning equipment had caused similar figures to be displayed in the data output. According to Aaron's NASA oral history, the values displayed after the lightning strike were identical to those he had encountered before, during the factory testing. Instead of the sensor values dropping to zero due to power loss, they produced these strange patterns. This recognition gave Aaron the confidence to contact flight controller Jerry Griffin and issue his suggestion on how to rectify the telemetry situation. Griffin, how's it looking, ECOM? ECOM, what do you see? Aaron, flight, ECOM. Try SCE to auxiliary. Griffin, say again. SCE to auxiliary. Aaron, auxiliary. Griffin, auxiliary. Aaron, auxiliary, flight. Griffin, SCE to auxiliary, CAPCOM. What panel? ECOM. Although sounding confounded by the suggestion himself, Griffin recognized the urgency of the situation and passed the action to CAPCOM Gerald Carr. Astronaut Carr activated his microphone to open the thankfully still functioning radio link to the spacecraft and spoke as clearly and firmly as possible. Carr, Apollo 12, Houston. Try SCE to auxiliary. Over. Conrad, try FCE to auxiliary. Conrad, what the hell is that? Gordon, fuel cell. Carr, SCE, SCE to auxiliary. Long pause. Conrad, try the buses. Get the buses back on the line. Bean, it looks, everything looks good. Conrad, SCE to auxiliary. At the bottom of panel 3, in front of Lunar Module Pilot Alan Bean, there were controls for the spacecraft telecommunication system. One of these controls was the three-position switch for the signal conditioning equipment, SCE. It had been flicked upwards to the normal position during launch preparations and would usually remain in this position throughout the mission. This switch position would have the SCE electronics use its primary power source. Yet, according to John Aaron, the problem appeared to be in this particular part of the system, and Aaron had figured out that the way to fix the problem was to select the secondary power source within the unit. Alan Bean's spacesuit gloved finger performed this emergency procedure, which resulted in the onboard instrumentation finally receiving normal power again. Within moments, clear data began to filter in onto the screens in mission control. Griffin, what panel, ECOM? Aaron, we got it back, flight. Looks good. Griffin, okay. The confident, prompt response from ECOM John Aaron, Pete Conrad's puzzlement over the exact switch to use, and Alan Bean making the critical move to turn the switch have become the stuff of spaceflight legends, especially among Apollo fans.
And so there was no need to dispatch three black cars to Timber Cove. Now that account took us nearly 10 minutes to tell. In actuality, the events took less than a minute and a half. Take a listen.
Altitude of my own half and velocity 1,592 feet per second. Okay, we just lost the pump shot, gang. I don't know what happened here. We're taking a wheel drop out.
Roger.
Plus one.
Fuel cell light, fitting 6-bus light, fuel cell, 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 having some problem. The rocket looks good, apparently.
Apollo 12 Houston, try SCE to auxiliary, over. SCE to auxiliary.
An instruction from Mission Control to Apollo 12.
ECOM reports the readings back.
Readings are back, says ECOM.
Mark 1 Charlie.
Now that was a hair raiser.
Watch Charlie. Flight Director Jerry Griffin taking a stable status now. Apollo 12 downrange 17 miles.
And that was an extract from my own reel-to-reel tape recording of the actual launch of Apollo 12. More about the mission of Apollo 12, the second human landing on the moon, in a few moments.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where this is the space show presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. In addition to presenting this radio program for Southern FM, we hold free monthly meetups. And at them, we often have a guest, either in person, which is usually the case, or in this case, online. In this particular case, from America. And we had our late Peter Irwood chatting with Joe Kerwin, who was an astronaut who was on the Skylab 2 mission, the first manned space Skylab mission. And guess who the commander of that mission was? It was Pete Conrad. And Kerwin had this remembrance of Pete Conrad.
Right, so here's your flight crew, yourself, and your commander, Pete Conrad, and Paul White. So obviously Pete had walked on the moon, but was still up for more space flight. And I think you indicated a while ago that it was a lot of the moonwalkers just left and did their other things, but Pete and Al Bean stuck around.
Both of them stuck around. And Pete's motive in sticking around, the only Apollo commander of a lunar landing flight to stick around, was that he had applied for the program with the original seven. He was rejected after having questioned a doctor about the roughness and carelessness of a certain examination. So he was skipped over. And his report said that he was psychologically unadapted for long space missions. And he said, "I'm going to show that son of a gun who's psychologically adapted for what." And so he was the most active, the most outspoken, the most energetic, the hardest exerciser, right down to after we splashed down and were about had been picked up and put on the aircraft carrier, and they were about to open the hatch, and he said, "Guys, come on down here, and what we're going to do is we're not going to let them come in and inspect us and take our heartbeats. We did all that. We're going out." And so we walked right across the deck to show that we were okay.
That
was Pete. And yeah, he was psychologically adapted.
And, an observation I have, I've never met Pete Conrad or anything, but just about every photograph, and part of the one you're looking at right now, you see Pete laughing or smiling. Was he a good influence on the crew, and his experience as an Apollo astronaut was helpful to you?
He was a great leader. He trusted his crewmen, so he led us pretty much, you know, in our areas of preparation, do what we pleased. We got together often and talked about it, and we did the same in flight. And it was a good crew with a commander who was an experienced leader and knew when to lead and when to let things go. So it was very good. I thought he was the best in Skylab. The second crew thought Al Bean was the best. That's as it should be, you know.
Absolutely.
Right on down to Jerry Carr.
And Pete Conrad sure was a bundle of fun. I met him and had lunch with him one day. He was over this part of the world to try and sell DC-10 aircraft for, was it McDonnell Douglas at that time, whatever it was. That was his task, his job, after leaving the Astronaut Corps. In 1979, he returned to the Kennedy Space Center and had a flirty time with Shirley Bassey. You know Shirley Bassey, of course, the famous British singer. And she's going to sing a song for us called Stargazer after chatting with Pete Conrad.
That you get to see some very exciting places around the world. And recently I found myself in the most exciting place I've ever been to in my life, Cape Kennedy, where I saw rockets and the control rooms and the astronauts, I mean, you name it. And when they asked me if there was anything else I'd like to see, I said, how about the moon's surface? They said, well, the impossible takes a little longer, but we'll do our best. And they did.
Who are you?
Pete Conrad. What are you doing in my suit?
This is your suit?
That's my suit.
Listen, Pete, did you have trouble with that ladder when you arrived on the moon?
I sure did. You know, I'm the shortest guy in the office, and Neil set his line a small step for him, but it was a big step for a little fellow like me.
It was much more than that, wasn't it, really? The first imprint that he made on the moon.
Small step for man, but a big step for mankind.
And you said?
I kind of spoofed it. I figured nobody would remember who was on the moon second. Who flew the Atlantic second? Nobody remembers. So I figured I was safe and having a little fun.
And you had fun?
Our flight wasn't that historical in nature, and to tell you the truth, I really had a ball on the moon.
Yes?
It's a great place.
How many times have you been into outer space?
Surely there's four of us that have flown four times, and I've flown four times. I flew two Gemini flights, one in 65 and one in 66, mm-hmm. and Apollo 12 to the moon, and then I commanded the first Skylab in 1973, which was 28 days. Sure wish you were along on that trip.
Do you have any plans to go up again?
What are you doing tonight?
Nothing.
Yeah, very seriously, if I had the opportunity to go back to the moon again, which we're not going to do, I would dearly love to go back to the moon. I really enjoyed that flight. Again, I think if they were going to have the large space station operation like I was involved in Skylab, I'd enjoy doing that. Mm-hmm. But really, the reason that I'll probably never go back, I mean, I've obviously retired, is that when I stopped flying in 1973, the United States was not going to have a program that would fly again until 1980.
I'd like to go to the moon. Is there any chance that, to become an astronautess?
Well, as you know, they've taken women in the program now, and, of course, I'd already left when that happened. If I'd have known that was going to happen, I might have stayed. Would you do me a favor?
Mm-hmm.
How about singing me a song now?
Oh, that I can do. But
you
before
can?
I do that, would you please tell me how did you go to the bathroom?
Well, only with a great deal of difficulty.
That's right.
longer the drop. Hey,
Shirley Bassey with astronaut Pete Conrad at the Kennedy Space Center in 1979. And Shirley Bassey, what a wonderful singer. I saw her in concert in 1968, I think it was, and absolutely marvelous conference. Now, the concert, I should say. Alan Bean is the second of those two moonwalkers on the Apollo 12 mission, the fourth person to step foot on the moon. And he was discussed recently by Stan Anderson, who was in the tracking section on the Apollo missions. He flew aircraft, the Araya aircraft. And here he is in conversation with Space Association member Len Halperin on the philosophy of Alan Bean.
It's a philosophy I heard from Alan Bean.
Apollo 12 lunar module. Number 4 man on the moon.
Yeah, lunar module. He had a saying that says, because I saw him in one of his interviews afterwards, and he said, if you have a song in your heart, you have to sing it because nobody else knows the words.
And that's
and I thought that
it's
was
not
so
bad for
profound.
A non-podium astronaut, but it's,
yeah, no, no. Well, Alan Bean is a very talented
he was very
painter.
Artistic.
Yeah. Oh, incredible!
When he came back from the moon, he became a painter. He spent the rest of his life painting.
Yeah.
What he did, he got all his old gear that he was allowed to keep from the moon, and he noticed that it had dust on it. So he figured that's the moon. So what he did, he ground it and mixed it into all his paints. So all of his paintings have a bit of the moon in them.
That's cool.
That's
yeah.
Cool. Isn't the early ones.
That's a little bit cool.
Till he ran out.
That was Stan Anderson and Len Halperin. We heard a song by Darren Heyman earlier on. We're going to hear another one. This one is about Alan Bean. And as noted there, after leaving NASA, Alan Bean became a talented painter. So here's the song. It's simply called Alan Bean, Darren Heyman, from the United Kingdom in 2019.
Since 1969, I found a greater truth at a godly altitude. Won't waste another day of my life. As we tumbled down to earth, as we felt the capsule turn, we saw the blue skies burn. See through me, I'm going to paint the moon for you. ever felt like giving up. I felt like giving up. Ever felt like giving up all the time. Ever felt like giving up. I felt like giving up. Ever felt like giving up all the time. Ever felt like giving up. I felt like giving up. Ever felt like giving up all the time. Ever felt like giving up. I felt like giving up. Ever felt like giving up all the time.
The following was recorded at a meeting of the Space Association of Australia.
So the speakers, Colin McKellar, he's a former geologist, but he's now turned to an Anglican minister in Sydney. He grew up the Apollo era, and as it says on the screen, he now runs the absolutely amazing honeysucklecreek.net website, which if you haven't been there, give yourself a month and just dig into it. It's quite incredible. It started off just being about Honeysuckle Creek and has now expanded out dramatically to other stations, the early days, and different missions, etc. So there's obviously a big section on Apollo, but there's also a lot of the other deep space and manned space flight tracking things in there as well. So get onto it.
Hi, everybody. Well, I've been given the job of giving a quick overview for the 50th anniversary of the background to Honeysuckle, Apollo 13, and the Australian story. In other words, to say Australia had a great involvement in space tracking before Apollo 13, and this is a quick picture of that. It's the Australian story, and it starts back in 1957, 1958, the International Geophysical Year, and the plans for Project Vanguard to get a civilian satellite in orbit around the Earth. Of course, the Russians upset some of that, but that's where it started. And if a satellite was to be put in orbit by the US, you'd need to track it as it passed around the Earth. And this was Australia's first involvement in space tracking. We already had the Weapons Research Establishment in Australia, part of the Australian Department of Supply, and I guess everybody knows that they ran the Woomera rocket range, which was a huge area for testing guided missiles and all sorts of other stuff from Woomera in South Australia. And that was set up in 1947. And that was the ideal place to put the first tracking stations, well away from any interference. The Woomera mini-track was set up on Range G, at the rocket range for the International Geophysical Year, and it was set up by the US Naval Research Laboratory. Built in 57, operational the next year, staffed by Australians, run by the Department of Supply, and NED was one of the very first. It was a very hands-on way of receiving satellite telemetry, both using the crossed arms of the mini-track, which used interferometry to work out when a satellite crossed the sky, but also to listen in on the early satellites. And this is some audio that that Bruce had on a tape that he recorded in, I think, 1963. He might correct me on that. This is how it sounded. That's a proper satellite sound, I think. Well, in 1958, NASA was formed and brought together in this civilian agency all of the different space-related activities of the US. And not long after that, the mini-track on the range at Woomera moved south of Woomera to the nearby Island Lagoon, where NASA's Deep Space Station was built in 1960. It was the first deep space station built outside the US. The first one, of course, being at Goldstone in the Mojave Desert in California. Second one, Island Lagoon, and then another one was built right out in the middle of nowhere. And you can, they also had administration buildings, a Baker Nunn satellite tracking camera, and in the distance, the mini-track set up, which also had a satellite tracking camera. DSS-41 is involved in some pretty important missions tracking the early spacecraft to the planet. This is one of the staff pictures fairly early on, and up to 100 people will be there, I'm told, at any given time. Iron Lagoon tracked the rangers and the lunar orbiters in terms of preparation for Apollo. You know, the rangers zoomed in on the moon and took pictures until they crashed into the surface. Lunar orbiters helped compile a highly detailed atlas of the lunar surface, helping to identify lunar landing sites. And, of course, the Mariners and the Pioneers were also tracked from Iron Lagoon. The station operated from 1961 till 1972. In the end, it was closed because it was so expensive to staff and operate a station in such a remote location. And that was one of the reasons Tidbinbilla near Canberra was built in 65. Well, that's WIMRA, and that was the first Australian space tracking. But about the same time, over just north of Perth, at a place called Mushay, on a bombing range, the first Australian manned spaceflight tracking station was set up. Opened in 1961, Mushay was a part of the Mercury Space Tracking Network, designed to track the one-man Mercury capsule around the world. Mushay had a telemetry and control building, pretty primitive, and a number of antennas for receiving voice and telemetry. And also about a kilometre up the road was a Vilort radar for getting precise ranging details on a spacecraft as it went over. Mushay's a big day. It was the 20th of February 1962 when John Glenn passed over on his first flight after many delays. He passed over Mushay on his first orbit, second orbit, and just to the north on the third orbit. Now, Perth turned on all the lights so that John Glenn could see. And Comtech Gerry O'Connor was the first Australian to call a space traveller. His job was to sit at that console, to monitor the communications, and when it established communications, to hand it over to the Capcom, and for Friendship 7, that was Gordon Cooper. He's sitting opposite Gerry O'Connor, and he had flight specialists, engineers, and flight surgeons with him as well. Of the Capcom speaking to the capsule as he went over, late on the 20th of February, just before midnight, 1962.
Friendship 7, this is Mushay Comtech. Friendship 7, this is Mushay Comtech. Do read, over.
Hello, Mushay Comtech. This is Friendship 7, reading you loud and clear. How may?
Roger, Friendship 7, Mushay Capcom. How may, over.
Roger. How you doing, Gordo? We're doing real fine up here. Everything is going very well. Over.
Very good, John. You sound good.
Roger. That was sure a short day.
Time passes rapidly, huh?
Yes, sir.
Shortly, you may observe some lights down there. You want to take a check on them out to your right. Over.
Roger. I'm all set to see if I can't get them in sight.
Roger.
Roger. I do have a light in sight on the ground. Over.
Roger, understand. You're just off to your right there.
That's affirmative. Just to my right, I can see a big pattern of lights, apparently right on the coast. I can see the outline of a town and a very bright light just to the south of it.
Hey, Roger, that's Perth and Rockingham you're seeing there.
Roger, the lights show up very well. And thank everybody for turning them on, will you?
Because the communications network wasn't good enough to ensure real-time communications. So they had somebody on the ground in each place. And you can see on that animation from the Mercury control in at the Cape showing the capsule moving from the view of Mushay to the view of WIMRA. And this was another station built. This was about 40 or 50 kilometres north of WIMRA, right out again in the middle of nowhere. And this was built on the edge of the range. Mercury station number 9. Was not a command station. It was receiving it couldn't command the spacecraft, but it was a fully functional tracking station. And it was built nearby the existing FPS-16 radar, which was already working on the range. And the person in charge of that whole area was Tom Reed, who later became the station director at Honeysuckle Creek. Well, back to Musée. Musée closed in 1963 when Mercury finished because a station further north was needed. And so, of course, after Mercury came Gemini, two-man capsule, and Gemini was to get long-duration flight practice to learn how to do orbital rendezvous in preparation for the lunar missions. And because of the launch azimuth and the fact that the more orbits you have, the track shifts north, a station further north was needed, and so Carnarvon was established. Carnarvon was built to support Gemini and then Apollo, also worked in as part of the satellite tracking and data acquisition network. It was a very large station. In fact, it was the largest outside the US, and you can just get a feel for this looking at this panorama of the site. Very widespread, had radar, had telemetry, had ranging, had all sorts of stuff. And this, the front part of that building there is the Apollo wing, which was added to go with the 30-foot Apollo antenna as well. Carnarvon was key for the first US spacewalk, Gemini 4. Ed Findell was the Capcom, and he gave the go for the spacewalk as the spacecraft passed over Carnarvon. Gemini 6 and 7, US rendezvous, Carnarvon had a very important role in the Gemini program. And the 9-meter USB antenna was built for Apollo. So Carnarvon, you could say a lot about that, but even more tracking stations were built. A lot of money was being invested by NASA. And over in the East Coast, Tidbinbilla was built. Tidbinbilla was built as the second deep space station in Australia, number 42. There it is just after opening. And here's the Prime Minister, Bob Menzies, opening it in 1965. Tidbinbilla was key in all of the early planetary missions. They tracked Mariner 4 to Mars and beyond. And this picture was taken after the first track in March 65. Tidbinbilla was the first station to receive signals from Mariner 4 after it was occulted by Mars, and Bruce was on the receiver. And some of these pictures were received, and of course they were a big shock to everybody. Mars wasn't supposed to look like this. Tidbinbilla also supported Surveyor, and Mike Dinn was there for Surveyor 1, all getting ready for Apollo. Now, with Apollo coming, an extra wing was built to the Tidbinbilla complex, and electronics and all of the equipment needed was built and put in there to support Tidbinbilla's role in being support for the nearby Apollo station, which at that point had not yet been built, but it would become Honeysuckle Creek. And they were linked together by that microwave tower, giving a link over the mountains. Now, Tidbinbilla today is one of NASA's three great deep space network stations, and we've got Glenn Nagle with us tonight, and we can't speak highly enough of Tidbinbilla and what is being done there now. Well, what else? Well, just to mention for completeness, Aurora Valley was established to the southwest of Tidbinbilla in the Canberra region, opened in 1966 to track Earth-orbiting scientific satellites. So, again, very different from deep space or manned space. They had multiple antennas, and the first station director was Tom Reed, who'd been at Wimmera, and then after this went to Honeysuckle Creek. And then, almost lastly, Kubi Creek was established up north of Toowoomba on the edge of the Kubi Creek Reservoir. It was a transportable ground station brought up on semi-trailers and put together. It was to work as part of the Applications Technology Satellite Program. And so Kubi Creek worked on some of the technologies we take for granted. It closed in 1970, was dismantled, taken back to the US. And only about 2 years ago, we found that antenna is now in the UK and still being used. They experimented with weather photography. And this might be the very first picture showing all of Australia from space. They experimented with satellite television. And in June 1967, we had Our World, which is the first global satellite television broadcast. 5 o'clock in the morning, I watched it. It was amazing. And Kubi Creek was the Australian satellite Earth station, which received and sent our contributions out to the world. And we contributed three live segments to that broadcast, which were seen right around the world. And one of them was from Parkes, the radio telescope. And what's this got to do with Apollo 13? Well, of course, we know Parkes did figure in Apollo 13, but our world helped us set up the technology. You see, the ABC showed that they could get live television through the microwave links from Parkes to Sydney. And similar arrangements allowed Parkes to serve as an auxiliary antenna for Honeysuckle Creek for Apollo 11, 12, 13, we're thinking of in particular, and later missions as well. So the technologies and the expertise were coming together for the Apollo missions to the moon. In addition to the NASA manned spaceflight network tracking stations at Carnarvon and Honeysuckle Creek and the wing at Tibbenbilla, thousands of Australians were involved in supporting Apollo, and that support was critical during Apollo 13. There was Parkes, of course. There was the ARRI, the Apollo Range Instrumented Aircraft, and they were supported in Australia by the Department of Civil Aviation and OTC, providing communications. They allowed coverage of Earth orbit and near-Earth orbit parts of the mission from over Central Australia and over the Pacific as well. During Apollo, they staged out of Townsville and Perth. And the OTC, the Overseas Telecommunications Commission, provided high-frequency radio links to the ARRI aircraft and satellite and cable links to the USA as well. NASA had a very important switching centre, a NASCOM, or NASA Communications Network Switching Centre, in Canberra at the Deakin Telephone Exchange. And a plaque has been produced. I'm not sure if it's there on the building yet, but it's been produced to commemorate that work. And there's Kevin Westbrook in the centre. He was in charge of that very important site. The NASCOM network was huge from around about the time of Apollo 11. Very simplified, but it just gives you an idea of the complexity of this huge NASA communications network. It was the most complex network ever built. And I guess there's only the internet that has really superseded it. So there we are, those stations all around Australia, all paid for by NASA, all staffed by Australians, which is a great advantage to us in learning all sorts of things. And then Honeysuckle Creek, last but not least, as the prime Apollo station, built specifically to support Apollo missions at lunar distances with its 85-foot antenna. Opened in March 1967, about 100 people worked there during Apollo. So that's a bit of background to Apollo 13 and what Australia had in place and what Australia had been doing.
And that was recorded at the Space Associations of Australia on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 13. And much of what Colin McKellar, historian from Sydney, had to say there applied, of course, to Apollo 12, which is the 55th anniversary of this week. This is The Space Show, which has a home on the internet. It's space.southernfm.com.au, space.southernfm.com.au, where you can find more than 1,800 features for your listening enjoyment and a few photographs as well. So once again, please visit space.southernfm.com.au. And if you want to know about the Space Association of Australia, then visit space.asn.au. That's space.asn.au. This is The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. And just a word of congratulations to the winner of the Booker Prize. It's called Orbital, and it's about life on the International Space Station. So look it up, if you will.